The date is February the 12th, 1976. Cecil Clark is 70 years of age. He is a commercial fisherman and a lifelong resident of Dipper Harbor. His keen, perceptive mind has acquired an intimate knowledge of a coastal community and a traditional lifestyle that has evolved from adapting to the Bay of Fundy's standards of discipline. The Clark family has played an important role in the development of Dipper Harbor and contributed much to educational advancement. For this interview, Cecil Clark is the narrator and will share some of his memories of the past. The interviewer is Ethel Thompson. When were you born, Cecil?
Well, I was born, I guess, April the 7th, 1905.
And where were you born?
Well, as far as I know, I think I was born right in Dipper Harbor. Right. I mean, my birth certificate gives Dr. Reynolds from LaPro. I know where he had an office in LaPro, as far as I know.
Yes. And what schools did you attend?
Well, the only school I attended was right here. And I know when I went, it was 46 on the register. That is correct.
In one room?
In one room, that's all there was. Because why I remember that, I think I was 46 or something like that. On the register, we had a peg, each one marked for her hang her clothes on. And if we didn't do that, we were told about it. That's true. We weren't always all there at one time, but that's how many was on the register. That's right. Yes.
And what year would that be?
Well, that's a good question now, because when I was 14, I had to figure out, when I was 14, I didn't go to school anymore. So I was 1910 to be about 1912 or 13 would it be?
Yes, 1919 would be 14 years.
Oh yes, yeah, 1990 would be 14 years. Well, that would be 1918, perhaps somewhere around there, yes.
Have you read very much over the years?
Very little, very little.
How have you picked up your knowledge?
Oh, anything I know, I guess. Whatever I learned from someone else, I suppose. Some of the older fellows, I worked with them and asked questions to them, what I could find out, and apparently, that's whatever I learned, I guess, was from them, I would suppose, I'm sure, yes.
Your mother, was it?
My mother was a school teacher, but that didn't help my education either.
I'd have to disagree with
that. No, well, I mean, not what I mean by that is that, I mean, you know, she cautioned me about going to school and everything,
yes.
But I mean, I was not interested, that's all there was. Graham went to school a lot more than I did, took in a lot more and everything, but I wasn't interested, and therefore I didn't learn too much, I guess.
Who was the first educator or teacher in Dipper Harbor?
Well, I think, as far as I know back or what I hear, it was my grandfather, Clark, I think.
John Clark,
John Clark, I guess. I can remember when I was a little kid, Frank Frawley, that lived at Point LaPro. That's young Frank Frawley.
Yes.
His father ran the whistle, and he, I think he wanted to become a lawyer or something like that, but he took lessons after he was out of school. He used to go there and take lessons or something. My grandfather used to tutor, was that what you call it?
A tutor?
Yes. Yes, I remember that.
And did they build a school in his time?
That I really don't know. When I first started going to school, I went in the old schoolhouse. That is it right there now.
Is that
That's right. Right. Now, while I was going to school, we went to school in that one while they built the new one right alongside of it.
Yeah.
That's right when I first started to go to school. And I suppose I was maybe 8 to 9 years old, somewhere around that.
Yeah.
I would think. When the new school was finished, we moved in that and they moved this one down the road.
That's not interesting. Was the new one larger?
Oh, yes,
yes.
Larger than this. Oh, yes, yes.
What kind of work did you do as a boy growing up?
Did
Did you have household chores?
Well, yes. We, in those times, yes. We mostly kept two cows, and more or less I had to milk them. I always had to go cow hunting every night, that is true, and looked after the barn besides that. And we always had to carry water for to wash with, and water at night for, and carry in the wood and things like that. But most every young fellow done the same thing in those times, you see,
yes,
as far as I know.
That is their choice.
And pretty near everyone had a cow and a horse around here. Most everyone had a cow, and quite a few people had a horse. Always to haul wood with them, to do some farming with them.
Mm-hmm.
We always had a horse to fodder. And,
what did they grow in gardens then?
Well, I suppose much the same as they did now, only a lot more. I mean, that we always raised potatoes enough to keep us through the winter and have enough to plant, and the cabbages and squash and vegetables, you know, different things. Oh, yes.
And did they plant any grain for?
We planted no grain, no. No, I say again, they planted oats, yes, that was for the horse, that's true,
yes.
Planted oats, but I thought perhaps you meant wheat or something. Yes.
Did you have to pick rocks out of the field or stones, or was that all done before?
Well, quite a few, but right here in our fields, why, it wasn't too bad that way. We never had to pick many rocks, but I mean, many fields around I know, old and new. In my, you know, before my time, the old house, I see fields with piles and piles of them, where they picked them and wheeled them in piles. But this land right here was not too many rocks in it. It was pretty good that way. But I still hated farming.
Yes. Now, Cecil, what do you remember about the coastal area? My professor said you have to see the Maritimes from the sea. Only way to approach them. So what did the coastal area look like as you came in and saw the cliffs of the rocks and the trees?
Well, I suppose that from the sea, I suppose it hasn't changed, you know, never changed too much in my time, but only that, I mean, on the shore, there's different places from I was a kid till now that, I mean, it's washed away, you know, in many places, the banks is receded back and washed away in a good many places. Down Duck Pond there, where it's just a beach now, far out on the beach there was fish houses and there was stands. Well, I say stands, there was things that they built. They used to have to lance their boat up and down on. That they didn't fish out of here, they fished out of there with small boats, but they had a big winch at the head of the wharf and they would land there and they had these, they were like skids on them, there was sunk down in the beach, you see, for to haul the boats right up and down. And I mean, now that's disappeared. I wouldn't know how far back that that has gone since I was a kid.
Would that be near to where the tops are?
That's sitting? Right. At that place where they drive down now, where, you know what they say, there's the land in there below,
yeah.
You know, below the red fence.
Renshaw's
fence, right,
yes.
There at that land. And there was fish houses right along there. There's nothing left there now at all.
Could you describe a fish house?
Well, it was just a fish house. It was just a little building big enough for to put some fishing gear in, and they used it for to salt their bait in, and just a little square building with a pitched roof and shingled. And they used that for putting their gear away in and what have you, see. Just as close to the water as they could have it, you know, so.
Was there a settlement there, is that
right? No, there was just about the three families lived there. There was old Charlie Thompson and Leonard and Alfred. There was, I mean, three different people. Three different families, I mean, but they operated out of there in that time.
Did other people operate?
No, they were the only people because they lived right there and that's the way they operated. As time went on and they got bigger boats and this, by they moved up here and fished out of here, you know what I mean. But as a rule, that was handy for them there then, and that's that worked.
And what about here? There must have been fish sheds.
Oh, there were fish sheds here when I was a kid, yes. Big fish sheds, fish stands where they processed in the buck, and they, it was a big thing then in the summertime. Everyone trawled, and Harkins just bought fish up the head of the harbor there. There was a fish den there. Also, at the head of the fish den, there was a top of it was rigged into a house, and people used to come from Nova Scotia, and they stayed in the whites, blue skin.
What was the blue skin?
Blue skin's the name. I never heard tell of it before. Bootleg. That's funny, but that's the name of the people that stayed there. And Kinghorn.
And they came.
I remember John Kinghorn. Yes, well, yes, they came from Nova Scotia, some part of Digby or over around there.
Yes, and Kinghorn bought.
They fish. Mr. Harkins bought fish, but Kinghorn's fished for him there. They'd come from Nova Scotia over here to get a chance to fish. In those times, it seemed to be hake. There was more fish hake on this side of the Bay of Fundy than there was over there. Because the vessels used to come here. Captain John Snow come out of Digby, the vessel Venus, and she laid at the wharf, and they brought a fleet of dory fishermen with them, and they bought fish here besides.
Could you give me an estimate of the year, an approximate?
Well, no.
You established that was in the, around 1917.
I would say somewhere close around that, I think, yes. And you want me to go over that again?
Yeah, Captain John Snow.
Yeah, and Captain John Snow from Digby came here in the vessel Venus. He brought a crew with him. They had their own dories, and they fished, and also they bought fish here. Because sometimes the fish stands here couldn't handle what they got all, and he would take them. And why they fished here is because apparently this was the only harbor that was big enough for vessels to lay in, and boats could get in and out at low water. So it was close to the fishing ground. And I guess in those times there was quite a big demand for salt fish, for hake especially. Hake only came in the summertime. And as far as I know, in those times that they shipped the most to the West Indies, and
They salted them and dried them
here. And they were shipped to the West Indies because in the hot countries, why, I guess at those times they had no refrigeration, and salt fish or dried fish was the only thing they could keep. And I guess to there they were quite a treat. But since those times, why, the market went bad and everything has changed.
When these fishing fleets came in, did the young lads here have a chance to bait trawl?
The young fellas, me too, we baited trawl, 25 cents a tub. And we cleaned the sounds, the hake sounds that was in the hake. There was, I couldn't quite explain to what a sound is, but it's, they used them for, they made fish glue off them. And we used to have to clean them, split them open and clean them, and we got 25 cents a pail for those. We used to clean them, dry them, pick them up, and put them away. And the sound is a thing in the fish that, the hake is the only thing that has a sound that will pull out. The other ones, it's a thing that they, I can't, just couldn't explain that, but they take in air and water bells, and when a hake comes so far up, he's taking that much air, it can't sink again. Another fish, perhaps I'm doing wrong on it. Another fish, I mean, they have no sound, and therefore they can let the air out of them as they come up, and they can sink again. But whatever these sounds, it was about 5 inches long, and when they were blowed up, it was about 2 inches around. And we used to split them open with our finger and clean them and spread them in flakes and dry them, and when they were dried, we put them away. And I, as far as I know, they made fish glue or some kind of glue of them.
Was it like a membrane, or what kind of a material was it?
Well, it was just, that's good, no bones or nothing in that.
No.
Just a soft thing that my fingers used to be swelled up. You just put your finger in that and push it like that and split it wide open. So you just spit it like that.
Yeah.
And they pulled them out. Let them do that. They stole the boat. I wouldn't know how they got the boat. They got it somewhere. And I can't tell you where they came from, Nova Scotia or the head of the Bay of Fundy somewhere. But they stole a boat and two or three pairs of oars. and they were nearly starved. They had
the German soldiers?
German soldiers, yes. And they had the last of the ones they were living on. They had green apples that they had got somewhere. Maybe they brought them with them or something, but they pretty much made it. But Fred Thompson, I remember that day, and they were harmless, but he had a Winchester rifle in the boat, and they came up and told them. They was reported that they were missing, you see, and they had everyone out looking for them, but apparently the fog came in, and the fog they didn't need it, but they were lost themselves, and he found them.
They were en route to the United States?
They were en route to the United States. They were smart enough. This officer, he knew, see, I mean, by maps or something, that he knew how to get there. You know,
yeah.
That he figured that they got this far, they'd make it, you know, but they're pretty near it, too. But anyway, Captain John Snow, they brought them in, and he took them aboard the vessel and fed them until the authorities came after them.
Yeah.
I remember that, and said, you fellows go back now and be good boys. The world will be over pretty soon, and you'll be free. Just like Hanford, you know, he was a smooth old
fellow. Yeah.
Elliot's came here from Tiverton to set up, put up a fish stand, because in the end there was just about one buyer, that was Jim O'Donnell, and he really couldn't handle what fish was caught all the time, and that is 6 days a week sometime the thing was plugged up. So Elliot's come here and set up a big fish stand, and they were quite a success for quite a while. We all worked there before we were big enough to go fishing, and that went on for a long time. And in those times, well, the new boats we got, one thing and another, why, they all had single cylinder engines. Therefore, you couldn't use too big of boats because you had to haul it by hand. Afterwards, about the time the trawling business was dying out, we got automobile engines, which was very good because you could slow them down and steam them up over the trawl as slow as you liked, and you could lift trawl twice as easy. You could use the drum head for to break out your anchor and get your work with, which was very much easier to me. And when I got all rigged up that way, things kind of went bad, and that was a sad disappointment. But anyway, lobster. Well, I mean, the market went bad. You know that the salt fishing market went bad. There wasn't a demand anymore. And therefore, right now, many people are out of trawling because it has moved to the draggers and wherever the market is, and big business, and the small fellows are out altogether pretty well.
And refrigeration.
And refrigeration. Instead of salt and fish, they're all filleted and refrigeration and shipped out, and things have changed very much. That all took place in this last 20 years, I guess, or 15 years, something like that. A lot went two men to a boat, and a lot went one man. I mostly went one man because we fished about three tubs of trawl. Sometimes on fine days we could fish four, what we could get baited in. Two men fish six or sometimes seven. That's about all we could handle out of here on account of so much tide. In different places where there wasn't that much tide, they could handle more gear. But our biggest trouble was getting baited all the time, because to bait a tub of hake trawl, it was rigged around 3 feet apart. That's the hooks were spaced about 3 feet apart, or a little 3 feet and a half, and look after the hooks to keep them sharp and bait them. Then if you could do one in an hour, you didn't have time to have a smoke anytime. You had to really move, and three tubs of trawl took cutting your bait and everything. Never lift your head, it took over 3 hours. That was quite a lot of the day going right there.
And did you set at low tide? Or
we would run the trawl about 2 hours to low water, run it down with the tide about 2 hours to low water, give it about an hour set. If it was a fine day and clear, we would go back to the first end we had set and break that anchor out and lift it with the last of the tide. Sometimes we would be, if we were too slow, tide would turn on us and we'd have to cut it off and go to the other end and lift back with the flood tide. And that sometimes caused a lot of hard pulling, I'll tell you.
How much did you get paid for your fishing?
Well, in the last First World War, I didn't trawl. they got $1.25 a hundredweight. That was a mighty big price. But mine was the fishing for hake. We got 50, 55, and 60 cents a hundredweight. And I fished them, if you want to hear this, in the 30s, as low as 30 cents a hundredweight, not a pound. And we fished 3 days a week, was all they would take from us. Now, you can imagine what we made at that. But we had to do it. I fished with different people when I was young till I got so old and I rigged out on my own.
This is salmon
fishing. And I'm just talking about the weather that they talk about freak breezes, but in 1933, one night, there was another fellow with me, and we went out, it was blowing hard southwest, which was quite natural and normal. We called them smoky southwesters. But this is in my life, and this once this happened. But as we started to run our nets, it blew harder. And once we got them out, we couldn't lift them again. And some of the boats that didn't run that soon got back in. And that night it breezed till the most wind I ever was in a small boat in my life I've ever seen. And I don't think it was anyone could have been any more frightened than I was. And there was a three-master schooner, this is Sea Talk, reaching on, and we were scared in the midst of it, we were going to get her, and the fellow was with me, had gone to sea in three-man vessels. And when she got almost to us, she lowered away her spanker and swung her off before the wind for St. John, the harbor, because of the wind that way, she couldn't get anywhere, maybe. And he said, that doesn't look good, because if there's that much wind, he figures, if he's doing that, he must figure on an awful lot of wind, or they wouldn't be running back to figure they couldn't get anywhere. And that night, it was a freak breeze, because it wasn't cloudy, you could see. After dark, it was about 8 miles off Point de Pro, you could see the light. And to look at it, you think it was traveling a million miles an hour. So the way it was going, that was with the wind. And it died out about 12 o'clock, and I don't think if it had died out. When the wind died out, the wind was blowing the top off the sea. When the wind died out, the sea gets worse. And we used to have to take an oar or sometimes start the engine when we'd hear a heavy one break and shove the boat up head to it, scared to let her lay there. And I think there was about 7 boats out of here, and the rest had got in, and that was not a word ever said about it. That was in that breeze, the tide raised that high, that over across the harbor there's an old fellow that fished salmon, George Danes, all his life, and he was old, and his boat was hauled up to where he used to haul it in the wintertime for safekeeping. And that night the tide raised that high that uploaded his boat off the blocks and punched a hole in it. So that's some idea how much wind there was. And that was on a Friday night. And on the next Friday night, there come another breeze, much the same. One boat in Warrenville was upset, and they got the fellas off it. In the end, that was only by luck. Another boat come along and got them off it. But that was two breezes that came in that year while I was at it. And before that, there was 2 or 3 people drowned before I ever was big enough to fish. I think it was in 1914 or 15 that that happened. But apart from that, salmon fishing was quite a job. I never liked it because you're getting too many messes, but still and all, it was a way of living and a livelihood, and it was good times with it too. So anyway, we carried on with that till they stopped us here 4 years ago now, I guess.
What do you feel about that?
We didn't feel very good about that, because we feel that for all the salmon we caught and the way we caught them, we would have never hurt them in any way. I guess since that, there's been more destroyed in one season up the river in places than we ever caught at the time we were at it. So that's the way of the government.
What do you remember of the Depression, Cecil?
Well, what I remember of it is that first of all, we talked about fishing. It got so that we couldn't sell any fish anymore, as far as trawling was concerned. that there was no more market. People didn't want them. They were so cheap you couldn't fish. And it was pretty hard to get anything to do. I worked on the roads. If you could get a job, I worked a while on the roads. But we could work a 10-hour day and get 25 cents an hour. And I do remember that three or four of us, if we could have it, someone would have a package of tobacco between the three or four of us. We made it last as long, we divided and made it last as long as it would. And many is the day we didn't have a smoke. That is right. And salmon fishing, they were cheap. I sold them as cheap as 11 cents a pound. And from that up to 15, 1 year, we thought we were doing well. We contracted to Zetsman in St. John for 16 cents a pound. And we thought that was great because he made us believe, or led us to believe, that we could go some night and get a good catch and we would know we were getting 16 cents a pound for them, and that really went over big. And in that time, the lobster fishing went bad. They were cheap, and they petered out till we couldn't catch hardly any. Couldn't catch enough to make it pay. There was 3 years that I never bought a lobster fishing because we couldn't make it pay. 1 year, we used to keep them then. There was no buyers. Right here at night, we used to put them in crates and keep them. And it was different people from Eastport or Deer Island came to buy them. And one time we had one fella come and he knew that we had, I think, around 200 pounds, another fellow and I. And we were in Jim and All's store and he knew we had that many lobsters. And he called us out in the yard and made us promise that we would never tell anyone. He would take a cent off the freight that he got for carrying, and he would give us 16 cents a pound for them. And we jumped at that. And we never told anyone about it for years afterwards. But that's just a little bit of how things was like in the Depression time. For myself, there was many times I didn't have hardly clothes, no clothes to dress up in, and no more than enough to cover me a good many times. I didn't feel ashamed of it because everyone was the same. I went to St. John in the summer. One time, banana boats used to run in there from the West Indies, and we thought we'd get a job there. And there was that many men that when that ship came in and they was putting crews on it to work, that you would be trampled to death with people looking for a job. So in the end, I guess I don't know what would have happened if the war hadn't came, I don't know, but in the end, it was a great chance for to enlist, and many of the young fellows went in the army, and therefore that changed the Depression right there. But apart from that, I don't know where we would have went.
What do you remember about the older men?
Well, apparently, when I'm a kid, of course, everyone, when you're a kid, looks quite old, but every fella had a mustache, and most of the older men wore a chin out beard, all but one man, old Mr. Harkins, and he was quite a man. He was one of the toughest fishermen, I guess, in our part of the country. Everyone talked about him, and in my day, I can remember him. I was just young, but I well remember him. And cold or weather, either one, I don't think ever dawned. As a rule, the old fellas, they seem to have more time than people do today, because if they drove down the road in their horse and wagon, they would stop and talk to you or ask you questions. Every fella smoked a pipe, and they would come to the houses at night and tell stories. And there was no radios then or no entertainment, and I do remember that me always glad to see when someone come in to listen to the wild stories they told. I guess some of them were true, but used to tell terrible ghost stories sometimes, and some nights I would be scared to go to bed. But with it all, I guess they were just worked hard and got what they could. I guess they didn't need too much money for, they raised most of what they ate, and on it went that way.
Can you tell me anything about the lumbering and what they cut in those days?
Well, I guess we all cut firewood and everything, but my father, well, he liked the woods anyway, but he used to cut pit props. I guess there was, well, props for the mine somewhere. I guess in the First World War, there was, I was only a little fellow then, but there was quite a big demand for pit props. But he used to cut a lot of pit props, and I don't know where they went to, and they used to cut boxwood. An awful lot of stuff shipped up for boxwood. I don't know where that went. But that in the winter, why, an awful lot. You know, people worked in the woods. Different people cut logs and things, but I was in the winter in the woods with him a good lot. I used to like to hunt an awful lot and set traps for one thing or another. But
what did you catch in your traps?
Well, I never was too much of a trapper. I caught wildcats, some wildcats, so quite a few. I caught an odd mink. I never caught an otter. I used to catch quite a few raccoons. But I guess I wasn't too keen a trapper, and maybe around here there wasn't just too much to trap. I caught a few mink, just an odd one. But we never got much further than those times. I think the wildcats, I think we got a bounty on them, and I believe maybe we got, I don't know, $7 or $10 for a bounty for a wildcat. But we used to do a lot of moose hunting. And to me, when I was young, the moose season, the moose just seemed to be coming into this country. Before that, there were lots of deer, but in my father's time, there was no moose, I guess. And it was a great thing then. They were just learning where to call moose and what have you, and I took a great interest in that. But in the end, I guess that's petered out now, so that kind of ended the hunting. And oh, I guess maybe now I'm too old to go at it anyway.
Would you care to shoot a moose now?
Right now, I'd rather just see one and let it go than to shoot it.
Cecil, what is a trawl tub?
Well, a trawl tub is just, we called it a tub. It was just a barrel, an apple barrel or a flour barrel, cut off that, a little over halfway up. And that was to hold what we called a tub of trawl. And we cut it off, put a hoop around the top of it and for to make it strong. And a tub of trawl is, we call it a tub of trawl because it's in the tub. You know, we put so much in the tub, but it is 600 fathom a line. It's, well, at least 300 fathom a line. It comes in what they call shot.
Yes.
50 fathom to a shot, and there's six shot is 300 fathoms. And it was just a small, well, a small line, quarter inch rope, or a little bigger than that. It was made out of cotton. Sometimes it was hemp, but it was, most of what we had was cotton, and it was tarred, steam tarred, American tarred. We called it steam tarred. And we put that all together, and we call them gengens or snoods. They would be about 3.5 feet long, and we rigged it about 3.5 to 4 feet apart. There was this snood with a hook on the end of it, about 3 and 4 feet apart. And
you coiled it in?
We baited that all. We dumped it out and baited it into the tub, and that's why we called it the tub of trawl when it was finished. That would be about between 500 and 600 hooks on a tub.
And
we run, one man alone, mostly run three, sometimes four. And a two-man boat would run six, mostly. Fine days and if everything was fair, if there was lots of fish going, maybe they'd run seven. But six was a good string, mostly.
Now, what kind of line fish did you catch on this?
Now, that was mostly hake and haddock. That was That was what people fished anywhere from here to the Grand Banks. That was the same system in every way.
How many fish would you catch?
On a good day, from off of three tubs of trawl, you would get a ton, maybe, or something around that. That was very good. Sometimes you get more, many times you get less, but on an average, I have seen boats with 6,000 and 7,000 off of six tubs, sometimes. That's true.
Now, you said one tub, was that off one tub?
That's off the string, three tubs.
Off three tubs.
Three tubs, that's off the string, yeah. That was your day's fishing, yes.
Now, what was your boat like for that kind?
Well, in those times, there was much the same style as we have today, only smaller. Much smaller, because we couldn't, before we got automobile engines, you had to haul the boat, it would blow, you had to haul it yourself, you know what I mean? Now we can use the engine to steam up over it, which is much easier, but the boats was pretty near the same. They were better going boats than they have today, but they weren't so wide, and they were longer and sharper, and to me,
faster,
and I like them. They fished the same in vessels, only they used dories. You know, they put the dories, or when the men fished in the dories, the same as you see pictures on the banks and everything, but it was all the same system. And the biggest job was bait and trawl. That was a slow job. I mean, you had to work. I mean, if you could bait a tub of trawl in an hour, you were doing good. You didn't have time to have a smoke or do any talking. And
did you have to sharpen the hooks every time?
A lot of the hooks, there was the points that when we run on what we call hard bottom, that would be rocky bottom places, a lot of the hooks, the points would be just turned over a little bit. We sometimes mostly had a stone right alongside. We just rub it across the stone, and that straightened the point out on it again, you see. But
what do you consider the best fishing boat that has been in here that they've used? See, so I know you have an eye for a nice boat.
I would say that I think the best boats we can get are the most all-around boats, I think, is what they call the Cape Island boat. I would think that they have all kinds, but I would say that for the easiest to handle and a good boat, I would think the Cape Island boats, perhaps.
Is that just a name, or were they built?
They're built in Cape Sable.
At Cape Sable.
Cape Sable, or Cape Island, we call it, and that's where they build them in many places now, maybe, but that's where they started, and that's where they come from, was Cape Sable. And there, that's all they use, they call them. Yet they're many bigger boats now, but they're all Cape Island style, just the same.
Have you ever been to Cape Sable?
Well, I've been around it, but down through it, yes, down through Barrington Passage, I guess there's a bridge across there now. I don't think it goes under it or through or not.
Did they get the wood right on the island?
That Cape Sable is lots of spruce and lots of pine, and that's where they get the oak. They use oak for the stem, the oak timbers, and mostly oak keel and everything, because everything there was all the frame was mostly of oak. And I don't know, but I don't know enough about that, but I mean, I know that there must be lots of oak there, because they're all oak. It comes from there. I guess there's a place called Oak Island, so maybe there must be oak groves there. But
Cecil, could you tell me something about Warren Clark? They say he was a carpenter.
Well, he was a carpenter, and I guess a pretty good one. He built an awful lot of the houses around here.
Can you name any of them?
Well, Well, he built Willie Thompson's house across the road here, and he built this big house of Ernie Shaw's in Pocologan, and...
His own, yes,
he built his own, and he built a big barn, was very much up to date for those times in every way. And apart from that, I think when I was young, I mean, he wasn't around, I think he went to Eastport and he worked there, and I guess he worked carpenter, worked there for years maybe, as far as I know, because he would come back here once in a while, you know, for a holiday or something, but he would, I just can't remember when he came back here. He came back to live in the inn, but I think he only lived maybe, 8 or 9 years perhaps. And he wasn't sick, he just died in bed like that.
When he went to Eastport, would his wife go with him?
Oh yes, they all lived in Eastport, see. Oh yes, they had 2 girls and a boy. They both died young. One was married, and she married a Holmes, George Holmes, I think, afterwards that he went to California or something, but I think they both died of TB. Yes. And Warren, that was a Hazen, we called him, but his name was Warren Hazen or something. He was a little older than I am.
Yes.
And when they come back here, when his father came back here, well, Hazen come back here with him, and he worked with his father on Willie Thompson's house here, Hazen did.
Did he?
Yeah, when they built that. And he left again and went back to Eastport or somewhere, and I couldn't tell you much about him anymore.
But, now, could you tell me something about Warren's own house? It was a rather unusual styling, wasn't it?
Well, it was. It was just, with all the houses he built and everything, why, that one, I wouldn't know why, but it was just, well, a small house, I mean. It was narrow. People used to laugh at it. They thought it was going to blow over. It was so high and so narrow. But it would just seem to me to be like 2 rooms. There was one end and then the other, and in between was a stairway that you went upstairs. And there was drawers, rows of drawers, from big ones and bigger sizes, smaller sizes, with everything in it. And he had his picture on everything, and he had the name of, and every drawer, what was in it, stamped the hallways around the house, just like that. Anything he wanted, he just pulled out the drawer. And
was
more like a cabinet file, only in a large size.
Was this nails and things a carpenter would use?
Nails, anything that a carpenter would use. All kinds of small tools for fine work. Nails, tacks, anything. He had things that, as far as carpenter work, that I had never seen. That he had everything that way. And it was a name on every drawer of what was in it, and that was put in its place, and the whole house was just full of that every way, yes.
And then did he do doors outside of the
doors? Doors, there was doors outside of them, and then, yes, there was big, like glass doors, you know, where they folded, yes, right along. Oh, it was fine work, I mean, you know, masterpiece, but I mean, for what reason, I don't know. Of course, I suppose it's better than throw it in a pile like I would somewhere, but...
And then what about his barn? How was
it
designed?
Well, his barn was big. And there was a place when you went in the front doors of the barn, why you walked in there, and there was partitions along where one place was a place to put hay and feed and stuff, and another place was a place where the hens were, and that was all plastered inside and wire netting around it, and there was... Well, like they have, you see pictures, like they have at these places for the hens to lay, and you gather the eggs and everything. And on where the cows were supposed to be, there was a stand there, and that was clean and everything up to date. And there was some kind of a trap door where you dump the bed and then everything down below, and you could back a wagon in under below and haul it away. And on the next, up the next flight of stairs, there was another. Well, it was like a workshop and different things that he would want, you know, and then above that there was another flight of stairs, and there was like an attic that stuffed a pile of stuff away, and beyond that you went up another flight of stairs through the top of the barn, and there was a lookout on the top of the barn that you could see for miles. I mean, it's high up there anyway, you know, and I've been up there.
Yes, did you tell me you could see Bald
Mountain? I could see what they call Mount Champlain Plain from there, Bald Mountain. Oh, yes, many of the times I used to go up there and look at it. Oh, yes. Yeah, and I don't know how far away that would be, but it's just nothing in between you, you know. It was so high, you could see right clear across. Oh, yes.
But why would he want a lookout? Was it just to...
That is what I don't know. I mean, that's maybe just for... Well, he done those kind of things that I can't answer because it was ideas of his own, maybe. Yes. It was a lookout. He told me, and I guess it's true, that on a clear day, just before a rainstorm, and when it's really clear, that he could see the tower in Eastport from there. And
it's
I think you
great.
Could, perhaps, yes, because I have seen Campobello Island and clear as a bell and all around and land beyond it that, you see up in the river into Eastport. And I suppose maybe it's the highest pinnacle right here, would it be?
Yeah,
there's nothing between it anywhere,
yeah,
I suppose, right. Yes. But he was a good carpenter. I mean, a lot of people, they didn't give him credit. And those times I know myself that he worked alone. There wasn't the tools, there was no power tools or anything. Then they used to kick about how long it took him to build a house, but it never took him that long. He built Russell's house over here, you see. And I think 32 days or something on Russell's house, which I would say that you couldn't get... Three men now with all the tools and all the equipment to build that in 32 days. Look how fancy it is, all the fancy work and everything the way it's put together.
Beautiful.
But anyway, I mean, he was like this. I don't know where he learned it, I suppose in the States where he was or something, but I mean, he just took a blueprint. You pass him a blueprint and he could just go to work. That was always do it. One time, I know I'm just young, and when they built this hydro dam at Seven Mile Lake, that was for the hydro and musquash that my father, he come after my father. They come after him to go to work out there. And he came after my father to go with him. He said if he wanted a job, he wanted two or three more men. So my father went, and he told me afterwards that when they went there, this boss, whoever was there, that was supposed to be there this day, that this I don't understand anything about, but this is what they told me, that the head man wasn't there, or the engineers or something, and Warren went there, and he was supposed to go to work, and he went and got the blueprint, or someone gave him the blueprint of the place, and he, whatever they called it, he said he went and found the benchmark or something, then he started them all to work. When the engineers come back, he was mad as the dickens about it, and he said he flew right in the air, and they went again, measuring, surveying, and they come back to Warren and told me he wasn't up a quarter of an inch. So he must know something about what he was doing.
Yes.
That's what I mean, you see. No one ever gave him credit for that or anything, but he could. And I mean, in Eastport, he mastered many of the factories that was put up there. And I mean, there's a lot of equipment, machinery, and everything,
yes.
Sardine factories. And I think perhaps that's why he went there. I don't know, but I just figured there was a lot of work in those days because... In Eastport, then the sardine business was quite a booming thing. It was just on the, beginning of it, a good lot. And it was many factories and many new ones going up and everything. And someone told me he built half Eastport. I suppose it was someone with him, but he was the master mechanic at that, yes.
Someone has said that he kept a diary, too.
He kept the diary, I guess, off anyone he knew, maybe, or of everything that happened pretty near, because when he died, people went through the old place and they picked up much stuff, some of diaries that was quite a joke of other people that they would read about, but once in a while they got something on themselves and they didn't laugh. But I guess he had a diary of everything that happened of every day for years, yes.
Isn't it a pity that something like that would be lost?
That's true, yes. Well, it just, everything went to pieces there, you know what I mean? Ethel, they stole everything, was there too. Once he died, the next day, they went into the house and they burned, they cleaned out everything.
Yes. And his tools, I suppose, are many of them would have come from England?
I couldn't say.
Or the States?
No, I would imagine more so in the States because, I mean, he worked carpenter work there and he was like this. He read a lot this way, that anything that was coming out new or anything, he read about it and he understood about it. He was interested in that, And he would get it or understand how it worked. And really, he never had any money. I think he spent everything he had in tools and stuff like this for the... He was always going moderate. I mean, things have come, he could see ahead that things that we wouldn't know, he would want to... This way, he would read about this is coming in style, or that's the way to do this, or the way to do that, and he was always about 15 years ahead, always, on things like that. People laughed at him, but I mean, I get thinking afterwards, maybe he should have laughed at other people.
Because
I think he could have, because he was a smart man that way, yes. Yes.
But, well, you can look at the homes.
Well, that's what
his
I mean,
are
yes.
distinctive.
Anything, yes, he
others,
built
yeah.
them. I mean, he had all the, and he knew how. Yeah. And I mean, he was mad if you just wanted a plain house like that or something. He didn't want to build it because he wanted something more up to date and more fancy. And
yes.
Look at this old house, I mean, like his father, I'm telling you about, up in Wilmot's there. I mean, that had all, everything. When you see many of these old houses years back, 100 years ago, they're all
carved
this,
around
everything,
the
leaves. Everything, the trimmings, and that's what he was full of, was that the, everything was a style. He would see that, but he wanted to build something different than that would look a little ahead of it or something, and apparently that's what he was like, I guess.
Yes.
But
do you remember him?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. I remember him. Oh, yes.
What was he like to talk to? Was he interesting? Did he tell about his designs, or was he more...
No, he mostly, more of his talk was about farming all the time.
Farming?
Yes, and I mean, he couldn't farm where he was, you know, when he came back. He got an old horse when he came back here, you see.
Yes.
And he planted gardens, but you couldn't grow much up there because it's all, there's no soil, it's all rock and everything. Yes. I do remember that he used to go down here and haul fish curry from the fish stands, you know, up and spread it on the...
Yes,
on the fields, for fertilizer, and he would spill. It would spill along the road, and we would raise Cain with him about that because you know the smell of it and everything.
Know.
But everyone done that in those days. But only, I mean, he figured in the end that apparently everyone was against him.
And did he really?
Oh yes, and he kind of had a chip on his shoulder that way. I think.
Yeah.
Oh, I never had any problem with him. You know, I mean, Omen was all right, but in the end, he. An awful lot of people, like, well, they were, I mean, I don't know why, maybe a little jealous of them. In the end, if you figured out the truth, yes. And, but anyway, poor fellow, I think he died a pauper, all right.
Did he?
Oh, yes, I think he did. Well, I mean, he didn't have any money, not any, no. As far as we know, I know he didn't know.
Yes.
But.
Well, had all of his children died before he did?
Well, yes.
And his wife?
His wife. No, just a minute. Ethel, I can't answer that question. No, I knew Armin. She was my aunt, or supposed to be, or my great aunt or something. But no, she was my aunt, wasn't she? My father's sister. Yes. No, I don't know. I can't remember that now.
Right.
I don't know whether... Maybe... She never came back here with me. See, he left her, and he came back here and lived, and she was in Eastport. And I remember her coming here... One time afterwards, when my mother was living, or stayed a few days, but I believe that she must have been living. I think he must have died first, maybe.
Yes.
I would think.
Would he be around when the breakwater was built down here?
Well, no, Ethel. I don't believe he was. I believe he was in Eastport at that time. Because what I mean is, in my young life, when I'm 8 or 9 or 10 years old, I might have seen him, but I never. Remembered him or seen him much until he left and come here to live in his last days. See, that's where my grandfather lived, in that house there, my grandfather Clark. My father's father lived in Warren's house up there. And that's all I could remember the house was, that he lived there, you see. But Warren came back in the end. It was his house. But all in my young life, I mean, I suppose, well... Hazel was older than I was. She was born in Eastport, and I suppose she was... Oh, Ethel, I would believe he maybe lived 40 years there, maybe more. I would believe, because, you know, from the time he came back here, maybe, I'd say 30 or 40 years he must have been there, yes. Oh, he was a real American.
Yes, he
was. Oh, yes. Thought he was, yes.
Well, now, did people really... appreciate his design. I can see that people that had a house built by him must have, well, they had the better house.
Oh, yes.
And did they try to get him to build for them?
Well, they wanted him to build, but the hard time they had was that they only wanted a cheap, plain, square house or something, you see, and that's what, he built Leonard Thompson's house in Duck Pond.
Did he?
And that was much against his idea, you see. You know, that's a
very plain
four-way house, and that was very plain, and he didn't like that in any way. But, he would build you anything you wanted, and he could, but I mean, he always wanted a little something fancy or something different some way.
Yes.
And the thing was, he could, if he, before he ever built a house, in his mind, he could see it. He knew how it would be built, and he could tell you every part of it, the way he would do it, you know, and he knew how that I couldn't do anything, but...
Well, you can see it. You can see a boat finished, you can see a house finished, can't you?
Perhaps in a way, a boat, I could know how to build that. Yeah. I would know how I could see it finished, but, I mean, a house, well, the thing is, to me, I don't think I ever took enough interest in anything about it, no, because, but...
Well...
Anyway, he could... That was his ambition. That was, I suppose, he spent his lifetime at it, I suppose, but with it all, he sure knew his stuff on that, all right.
Yes.
Because.
What happened to Warren Safe?
Well, that's a good question, that it never was found. He had it. I know Miss Luthy had it because I've seen it many times. But in the end, they think he buried it. There's a woman here, Mrs. Kane, that said that he told her one time, I've done something today they've been meaning to do for a long time, and she never knew what it was. But people now think that perhaps that's what he meant, that he had taken the safe and buried it. But no one knows yet whether it was buried or whether someone got it. That's a good question. It's never been seen since. And people thought he had money and they could find the safe, they'd really have it. But I myself don't think the poor old fellow had anything. I mean, whatever was in the safe, it might have been some belongings. He might have had a little money or something.
Yeah.
But I mean, if he buried it and is still buried, why, good enough. But no one knows. It's a good question because if someone says, oh, well, someone might have got it, they could have. That's true. And besides, it still might be buried. I'm sure he was smart enough. If he was going to bury it, he would put it someplace where no one would ever find it.
Yeah.
And I know that about him. So. Maybe it's like a treasure hunt is still there, perhaps if someone can get it. I...